Bill. And those are very valuable for the final. The final will have short mini-essays just on the last half of the course since the midterm. The more comprehensive essays could range over the entire course, although might be weighted slightly more towards the second half of the course. I also want to take this occasion to thank Kevin Thornton for the assistance he's given us with the loudspeaker and the mics and so on. It's just an invaluable service to be able to have all of that taken care of and the lectures taped and so on. So thank you very much, Kevin, for your help. And I do want to thank especially publicly the TAs, Jim Tantillo and Carl Johnson. Want to thank Jim also for lecturing, and Michal Smart, want to thank her for her lecture. I really have very much appreciated all that they've done. There's always a certain... let me mention also that I'll stop about 5 minutes early so that you'll be able to fill out the course evaluations. Those are helpful, actually. You don't get the benefit of them, but suggestions that you make, particularly in the written part, are often helpful for the years following. So there's a kind of intergenerational responsibility here that I urge you to exercise. There's always a certain sadness that I experience as I come to the end of a semester. I must honestly say also a certain sense of relief. It's nice to see all of you go home. But I think just as it's nice to see you come back in the fall, but there is a genuine sadness because I realize that much of what I've learned over the years, I've learned from my students. You may not always be aware of that. The power structure is such that you're often aware of a very different status and so on. But I honestly have to say that my students have taught me more since I've been at Cornell than my faculty colleagues. And often it has been because you've asked questions, you've shared insights that you've had that sometimes at first didn't seem to make much sense to me, but on further reflection made a good deal of sense. And I want to thank you for that. I really want to thank you for taking the course. It's always an honor to a professor to have students take the course, especially if it's not a required course. There, you don't have the same situation, and I've never liked teaching courses that were required, but there is a certain sadness. The last lecture sometimes gives a chance to take a larger view of what we've been up to. This course has been strange in some ways. It's been reasonably theoretical. It's talked about a lot of things that at first might not have seemed very intelligible or very useful. Right towards the end, we've talked about some things that are more practical. But it's a course that I would hope would give us some greater understanding of who we are and how we're situated in the world. And one of the dangers that I see as we think about important issues like the environment is the danger that is really true of virtually all social change. I'm going to turn this off and then turn it on again towards the end, if you'll remind me, Jim, towards the end, because it's a little noisy up in front. The danger that Niebuhr points to so well, that there is always that temptation to overemphasize our own virtue and overemphasize the villainy of our enemies. And I think at that point, the Jewish and Christian understanding of sin, perhaps more specifically the Christian doctrine of original sin, is a very powerful tool because at its best it always ought to remind us that none of us ever escapes that human dilemma. The classical Christian formulation, simul justus et peccator, at the same time justified in a sinner, I think is a very healthy reminder that no matter how right we think we are, no matter how virtuous we think we are, we always are part of that common human predicament of liability to error, of preferring our own benefit and welfare to that of others, and to overestimating the certainty and correctness of our own understanding, and so on. I think Niebuhr is very, very helpful at that point. And one of the particular problems faced in environmental issues is that the scale is so large. Human beings seem to be fairly good at solving very particular problems. We are problem-solving animals, and we're very effective often in solving very specific problems. But there's a great deal of historical evidence that when it comes to the larger scale, that it's not at all clear that we really are smart enough to be able to deal effectively over the long run with some of those big problems. Hegel, the philosopher, wasn't so sure. Niebuhr wasn't so sure. People in our own day have looked at some of the failures of urban planning, where the very thing that was supposed to have solved our social problems exacerbated them. Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis was a nice example where in less than 20 years from the time of laying the cornerstone, they had to tear it down because it was such a disastrous social failure as an example of urban housing and urban renewal. 20-story towers that were just saturated with crime and human failure. Brasilia is a nice example. Most people who have lived in the planned capital of Brazil have found it somewhat dull. Doesn't have the vitality and the excitement of Rio or Sao Paulo or other cities. And I think these stand as symbols in a way of how extraordinarily difficult it is to plan very far into the future. Our relations with the Soviet Union, I think, have been a nice example where only a few people clearly saw the threat from a powerful Soviet Union in the post-World War II period, and where it changed the shape of the world for a very large part of my lifetime. And we still don't know the last chapter. And I think as I reflect back over the kinds of subject matter that we've dealt with in the course, there's that constant sense that comes to me that maybe we just aren't smart enough after all to make some of these large-scale decisions. Some of us look at what's happening in Rwanda and Bosnia and other parts of the world, and we realize that even good people don't really know what to do. It's not simply a matter that bad people are in power. Very committed people really don't quite know what to do about these extremely difficult situations. And to some extent, I see that also as our situation with the environment. We have certain ideas about what to do. Some of them we're not even so eager to do. Let me give you just a tiny little vignette that I think captures the human predicament. I heard on the news last night that lawnmowers, these little gasoline engines, to run one an hour produces as much pollution as to run an automobile 11 hours, a new automobile. My first reaction on hearing that was, aha, I better get out and buy one quickly before they put all these controls on and they get expensive and temperamental. I better get one right away. And then I sort of laughed at myself and realized that is a fairly common reaction, that actually being concerned about the environment is fairly costly. Now, that's a kind of Silly example, but it's not so silly to think about the trip that you've planned to ski at Breckenridge or the trip down to the Bahamas or whatever and the amount of fuel and pollution and so on. It's difficult to lead an environmentally sensitive life. And I think it's because of that that sometimes instead of facing this ambiguity in our own existence, in our own lives, we are often tempted to point the finger at others. Those villains over there are the ones who are causing all the trouble. And on the whole, that's not a very fruitful thing to do. I think some of the experiences we've had with planning also make us skeptical at times about large-scale planning, and there's a strong temptation to retreat into a kind of narrow problem-solving. And I understand that temptation, and I guess that we will never totally resolve that issue between planning and problem-solving. The danger of planning, of course, is that we pretend we're a lot smarter than we are and make some horrible mistakes in the process. The advantage of planning is that the planner at her best is one who dreams, who is able to play with new ideas, is able to use her imagination in a bold and exciting and wonderful way to envision new worlds. And it's a method that is based on a kind of open-endedness, not just based on guilt and what's wrong with the world, but what could the world be like at its best. There are a lot of advantages to planning over problem-solving. Problem-solving tends often to be much narrower, based on a sense of failure and guilt and what's wrong with the world. It tends to look just at that particular issue. But the danger, of course, with planning is that it's precisely that large scale of it that makes us liable to the temptation that we pretend we're smarter than we really are. And we've seen enormous grief come from social schemes. Perhaps the most notable one in our own lifetime is that of state Marxism, where tens of millions of people have been killed because of people who had a vision and a plan. So I think we're caught in that kind of a tension between the open-endedness of planning, but on the other hand, the danger that the plan will overstep itself and become oppressive and coercive. There's a certain sense in which I think the planning stance is thoroughly compatible with biblical religion, in that the Bible, I think, never focuses on human sin, failure, what's wrong with people. It focuses on the reality of the kingdom of God, that is, on what might be right with the world. It's future-oriented. But at the same time, I think that ought to give us pause, because cultures that have been informed by biblical religion, that have been informed by Islam and Judaism and Christianity, have often been very overbearing cultures. They've been cultures that have been not at all bashful about forcing themselves on others. They have been imperialistic at times. And that is part of the danger of a cultural milieu, a religious orientation that focuses on the concept of the kingdom of God or its secular equivalent, that we can overstep ourselves. We can become too impatient with the messiness of ordinary human life. And thus, I think we live in that tension between focusing too narrowly just on the individual problems and focusing so broadly and at the same time failing to recognize our own limitations that we bring about more suffering and grief than we end up solving problems. It's in that context that I want to say a few things about a theme that has occupied my attention for many years, the theme of praise and celebration and thanksgiving. And to some extent, the rest of this lecture is reasonably autobiographical, although not obviously so. I've proposed the thesis that one of the things that could save us from some of the heavy-handed oppression of the planners, the central planners, is if we could learn to relate to the world about us in a mode of celebration and praise and thanksgiving. That is, if we could take some of the ideas, for instance, that I presented on Tuesday about play and celebration, leisure, worship, and so on, I think these could moderate some of our obsessive need to control everything. It seems to me that there's great wisdom in some of the Oriental religions like Taoism and Buddhism and so on, when they urge people to stop what they're doing, don't be so frantic, don't be so compulsive, just stop what you're doing and try to understand more of the world in which you live. Be quiet inside. There's a sense in which if we can better understand the givenness of life, what actually is, I think we will be in a much safer place to think about changing what is. I think this is part of the problem, for instance, of things I mentioned in the last lecture, such as Soviet art and architecture. Instead of seeing art as a celebration of life, as an interpretation of life, art became part of the revolution. It became extremely useful. It was something that was politically correct in the worst sense. And travel through Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union and look at the utter dreariness of their buildings and so on. Art was corrupted because it became too quickly, too severely utilitarian. I wish I had time to develop for you the evolution of May Day, a time that originally started actually in America. It was a day when rental contracts expired and people moved often from one lodging to another if they could get cheaper rent, gradually became associated with the labor movement. But its evolution in the Soviet Union was particularly interesting because May Day, May 1, eventually became the day when the nation state paraded all of its military hardware. It was the day when all the big tanks and missiles and all of the military hardware were paraded through Moscow and so on. And I see a fascinating evolution there, because in a culture or a state, I should not say a culture because there always was the underground in Russian society of people who did know how to celebrate, but when the state becomes too severely utilitarian, when it has nothing comparable to the Jewish Sabbath, then the logical development, I think, of that is that the military hardware becomes the ultimate symbol. Because if you cannot take the risk of keeping Sabbath, and it was a risk because the Sabbath meant you didn't work, you weren't working towards feeding yourself, you weren't harvesting the crops, you might lose the crops, and so on. If you could not trust God or life enough to keep Sabbath, then you damn well better secure yourselves through your weapons. And it seems to me that in a state that has no sense of Sabbath, no sense of celebration, no sense of festival in the original sense that Aristotle speaks of festivals in terms of the celebration of the gods and so on, then the final evolution of that is you'd better have big and effective weapons because you're on your own and it's a nasty world. And that's why I think that I have stressed so much in the course the theme that we are best able to relate to the environment when we feel existentially wealthy. Because that's when we can afford to be generous, we can afford to pay attention to the non-utilitarian, we can afford to see wilderness and nature as beautiful and mysterious and valuable in itself and not just as a natural resource. So one of the themes that I would emphasize is that we, if we're going to do large-scale planning, that we try to do it more within the context of celebration and praise. I think this would deliver us from some of our compulsive need to be in control, to be the master, the conqueror, always changing and improving things. I think it would put us in touch with some of the deeper wellsprings of joy and delight. We would see that nature has a value in itself and is not just for our utilitarian well-being. I think that part of my thesis is reasonably uncontroversial. I don't think that that's that difficult to comprehend, that if we could celebrate nature better, we might treat nature better. It used to be years ago in the course that I asked students to spend a few hours looking at some of the Ansel Adams and Elliot Porter nature photography as a way of getting some of that sense of what nature is about, and we may do that again. So this part of my thesis, I think, is not terribly controversial. But I think there is another dimension of praise which you picked up in the article that I assigned for this week, in one of the articles, that is much, much more controversial. And I'd like to suggest that also as a part of the framework. Namely, that I think it is possible to learn to praise God and celebrate life not just for the good and beautiful things, but even for the painful, the difficult, the destructive aspects of human existence. And I'd like very briefly to explore that theme. I first came in contact with this idea some 25 years ago when I went through an unwanted divorce. Someone put a book on my desk at Earlham College, to this day I don't know who it is, that had the title Prison to Praise. It was written by an army chaplain, Merlin Carruthers. That didn't help me any because I was a pacifist. And anything written by an army chaplain was automatically suspect. I opened the book, was just about to heave it, when I saw a few lines that sort of intrigued me. And I started reading the book and was very much aware that it wasn't the greatest grammar, that it was not written by some eminent scholar. It was a bit sloppy in some of the style and so on. But I kept reading the book and found myself very fascinated by what the writer was saying. And as I got into it further, I found that I began to be very, very silent inside. Very quiet. And that's unusual for me. I love to talk. My folks tell me I didn't talk till I was 3, and then I never stopped after that. May be true. And I became very, very silent inside. And I found over the years that's a thing to pay attention to. When I get deeply quiet inside, usually something important is happening. And I found that this book had an enormous influence on me. Let me very briefly explain what the book was about. Carruthers argued a theme which at that time I had never heard of, but since have found is fairly common in Christian mysticism and in other mystical traditions, that one can celebrate and give thanks not just for the good things in life, but also for the painful and difficult things. One of the examples that sticks with me till this day was that an army wife came to Carruthers, who was chaplain, and said, "I've got a huge problem. I need your help." She said, my husband is an alcoholic, and either he's drunk when he gets home every afternoon, or he's drunk before the evening is out. He's making life extremely difficult for me and the children. And she ended up saying, whatever you do, don't try to talk me out of leaving him. I'm going to leave him. Carruthers was a fairly intuitive person, and somehow between the lines, he heard her say almost the opposite. He heard her say, I desperately love this louse. I love this guy more than I can say, and I don't want to leave him, but it's just too hard to stick with it. And Carruthers turned to her and said, have you thought about thanking and praising God for the fact that your husband's an alcoholic and that he's made your life very difficult? And she was horrified. She almost jumped out of the chair and ran away at that point, apparently, from what she said later. But something made her stay, and she said no, that she hadn't, and they talked a little, and Carruthers said, let's do that right now. Let's thank God. I want you to thank God for the fact that your husband is an alcoholic. Well, she did. She didn't have much confidence in it, but she went ahead and they had a brief prayer and did that. Carruthers didn't hear anything from her. About 10 days later, he called her and said, how are things going? And she was just ecstatically happy. She said, oh, things are wonderful. She said, my husband hasn't touched a drop of alcohol over the last 10 days. And then she said, don't you think you ought to talk with him once more? And Carruthers said, well, I haven't talked with your husband. I've never met him. And she said, wow, this is really a miracle. And Carruthers said, maybe it is. Now, I know enough about psychology to know that one could give a very different explanation of what happened. It might just have been possible that he hadn't been drinking that afternoon, and that when he got home that afternoon, he sensed that something had changed in his wife, that perhaps for the first time she accepted him just the way he was. And let's just imagine that he had grown up in a home where love was always conditional, and where in order to really find out whether someone loved him or not, he always had to be the naughty boy. But he sensed something had changed, and that broke, or in psychological terms, decathected the chain, be naughty in order to see if people really love you. It's a very costly way of living, but many of us try that sometimes. And it just happened that he wasn't drinking that day, and the psychological reality became clear to him, and they lived happily ever after. That is possible, and I think it's conceivable that something like that happened. But I have found over the years, both in my own life and in the lives of those close to me, that it has been much more effective not to try to change other people, that is very clear to me, but not even necessarily to try to change myself before I give thanks to God for myself just the way I am, and before I give thanks to God for other people just the way they are. Even when they irritate me, when I find that they've treated me badly in some cases, and so on, not to try to change them, but instead of trying to accept them, which I usually have psychologically not been able to do, to try to give thanks for them just the way they are. And strangely enough, in many, many cases, I found that I have been able to accept the person, and even more than that, in a number of cases, the person has strangely changed over the months and years after that. That somehow in that deeper acceptance, the other person had the freedom to change. And as I have stopped trying so hard to change myself, I've seen the same dynamics, that I've had the freedom sometimes to change and to grow beyond some of those things that had nagged me so badly. Now, there are qualifications to this. Carruthers gives several of them, and I would add one or two myself. He would say, for instance, that God does not necessarily will evil for our lives. In fact, I think he clearly does not. This method of praise depends on the distinction between God's directive will and his permissive will. He permits evil things to happen to us. He does not will them. Secondly, it's not a psychological or a religious gimmick or trick, a kind of power of positive thinking designed to make a person like or accept what she really hates. That is, you don't use this deliberately to try to get yourself or another person to change, because that's just putting a different kind of psychological pressure on yourself or others. It has to be a genuine letting go of the situation. Thirdly, it's not an invitation to masochism, encouraging one to welcome or even seek pain and suffering. Pain and suffering are not good. They're unpleasant. They're to be avoided. Fourthly, it's not a theological formula for getting God to change his mind and help us out of difficult situations. It's not a way to manipulate God. I'll praise you, Lord, if you'll get me out of this difficult situation. And fifth, it's not a denial of the reality, the awful reality of evil. I would add my own qualification to the five of Carruthers and say that I've gradually learned over the years that such praise to me seems relevant only in those situations where I am somehow personally involved. I have never quite felt called upon to praise God for the napalming of children in Vietnam or the Holocaust or situations like that. Only situations where I was in some sense personally involved. This is a discipline, not a matter of how one feels. It would be psychological suicide, of course, to pretend that one liked some of the kinds of things that I've been talking about. Interestingly, as I got into this theme, I found that this theme that Carruthers talks about is actually fairly widespread in Christian literature and in the literature from other religions. I'll focus just briefly on a couple passages from Christian devotional literature. William Law, an 18th century clergyman, says, for instance, "If anyone could tell you the shortest, surest way to all happiness and perfection, he must tell you to make it a rule to yourself to thank and praise God for everything that happens to you. For it is certain that whatever seeming calamity happens to you, if you thank and praise God for it, you turn it into a blessing." Helen Keller, who became totally blind and deaf not long after birth, wrote, "I thank God for my handicaps, for through them I have found myself, my work, and my God." Charles Wesley, the founder of Methodism, writes something surprisingly similar. I was greatly surprised when I found the philosopher Nietzsche, the most unlikely candidate, saying things like this. He says, "To have joy in anything, one must approve everything." Or when he says, "If it be granted that we say yea to a single moment, then in so doing we have said yea not only to ourselves, but to all existence." What I think he's getting at is that unless somehow one believes that the larger scheme of things makes sense and is in some sense good, I think it's hard to enjoy any particular moment. Rainer Maria Rilke, the 20th century, early 20th century German poet, in language that is in to be sure, somewhat sentimental for us today, but rather powerful language, writes in one of his poems, he says, "Someday, emerging at last from this terrifying vision, may I burst into jubilant praise to assenting angels. May not even one of the clear-struck keys of the heart fail to respond through alighting on slack or doubtful or rending strings. May a newfound splendor appear in my streaming face." How inconspicuous, I left out a couple lines here. I was trying to type with a sore finger, so I'll have to skip that. He talks about sorrow and suffering and nights of affliction. And here are the lines then that I particularly want. He says, we wasters of sorrows. We wasters of sorrows. How we stare away into sad endurance beyond them, trying to foresee their end, whereas they are nothing else than our winter foliage, our somber evergreen, one of the seasons of our interior year. Not only season, they're also place, settlement, camp, soil, dwelling. We wasters of sorrows. If I had more time, I would quote a few of the biblical texts that also touch on this particular theme. Passages such as that in 1 Thessalonians, where Paul writes, give thanks in all circumstances, but I think the King James is probably closer to the original Greek when it says, in everything, give thanks. Or in Romans 8:28, we know that God works everything for good with those who love Him, and so on. Now, how do I relate this to environmental issues? I would like to suggest that whenever we try to change the world, let me make it more specific, because I think it would be arrogant for me to generalize on this. This is really a theme that I've developed for those who are part of the religious tradition. I would suggest that whenever Christians try to change other people or the world about them, which is always a risky thing to do, whether it's changing the environment or other people, that they always start by having a service, a worship service of celebration for their enemies. That you start your effort to clean up the environment by getting together and thanking God for the polluters and the people who aren't taking care of the land and who are indifferent to the pain and suffering of animals. And I think that something would happen in that kind of a milieu that would temper and dampen and ameliorate our excessive self-righteousness and our overweening confidence that we know exactly what's right for other people. It would help us strike a middle course between a kind of quietism. I think this is the danger of Buddhism and Taoism and so on, is that you just let it all flow and don't try to change much of anything. It would strike a middle course between that and the perennial temptation of Western culture and biblical religion that we are so overzealous to make the world a better world that we run roughshod over the rights and interests of others. So what I'm suggesting is not an indifference to environmental pollution and despoiling the land, but a way of preparing ourselves to enter the fray that would curb our excessive self-righteousness and arrogance as we try to change other people and the world about us. And we would do that by first having a time of celebration for our enemies. Because I think if we did that, we would get just a little bit of a glimpse that life is not nearly as black and white. We're not nearly as virtuous as we think. Issues are not always as crystal clear as we might hope. That we would start with a time of celebration for the very people that are causing us grief. As I thought about this, I have tried to develop some new metaphors for talking about God. I'm sure you're aware that none of our God language is literally true in one sense. God is not a rock. He's not he doesn't have feathers. It says he hides us under the shadow of his wings. God is not a fortress. He's not even a father in any ordinary sense. All God talk is metaphorical to a certain degree. I don't mean it's not true, but it's metaphorical. We use analogies, metaphors, and so on. And as I was wrestling with this, I thought, what kind of metaphor could capture something of this insight? First, I thought of God as the great cosmic garbage disposal, and then I realized that garbage disposals aren't ecologically sound. And I finally found another metaphor that I think is rather nice. I think we could describe God as the great cosmic compost pile. And what I mean by that is something like this, that it seems to me the passages in the Jewish scriptures that talk about the suffering servant, or the passages in the New Testament that talk about the suffering of Christ, in a way suggest to us something like this, that just as happens if you keep all of your garbage in the kitchen and refuse to put it out in the compost pile, after a while it begins to stink and it pollutes and corrupts your environment. Similarly, if we hold within ourselves all of our bitterness and resentment and anger, either against ourselves or against others, against those who are destroying our environment, I think that too, after a while, begins to pollute and corrupt us. Because I think resentment and anger are some of the most destructive of human emotions and cut us off from much beauty and goodness. And what it seems to me the Christian story is saying is that if we give our resentment, anger, bitterness, failure, sin, and so on to God through Jesus Christ, there is a kind of strange process that happens, what one writer has called the alchemy of grace, that the very failure of our lives can become the seedbed of new life. Just as happens with a compost pile, the very garbage itself, transformed through the compost pile, becomes the nutrients for roses and vegetables and all the rest. So that instead of denying our failure and our shortcomings, denying our anger and resentment, we let go of them, and they can be transformed, I think, and become the basis of a new life. So I would suggest that we start all of our social activities by giving thanks for our enemies, for those that make our lives so difficult. Let me close this, and then you'll have about 5 minutes or so for to fill out the forms, with two poems, one from Rainer Maria Rilke, and then I'll repeat something I read earlier from Thomas Merton. Rilke says, "Tell us, poet, what is it you do? I praise. But the deadly and the monstrous things, how can you bear them? I praise. What right have you to be true in every disguise, beneath every mask? I praise. And how is it that both calm and violent things like star and storm know you for their own? Because I praise." And then let me close with this wonderful quote that I used once before, I think, from Thomas Merton, from his book, The New Seeds of Contemplation. He says, "What is serious to men is often trivial in the sight of God. What in God might appear to us as play is perhaps what he himself takes most seriously. At any rate, the Lord plays and diverts himself in the garden of his creation, and if we could let go of our own obsession with what we think is the meaning of it all, we might be able to hear his call and follow him in his mysterious cosmic dance. We do not have to go very far to catch echoes of that game and of that dancing. When we are alone on a starlit night, when by chance we see the migrating birds in autumn descending on a grove of junipers to rest and eat, when we see children in a moment when they are really children, when we know love in our own hearts, or when, like the Japanese poet Basho, we hear an old frog land in a quiet pond with a solitary splash, At such times, the awakening, the turning inside out of all values, the newness, the emptiness, and purity of vision that make themselves evident provide a glimpse of the cosmic dance. For the world and time are the dance of the Lord in emptiness. The silence of the spheres is the music of a wedding feast. The more we persist in misunderstanding the phenomena of life, the more we analyze them out into strange finalities and complex purposes of our own, the more we involve ourselves in sadness, absurdity, and despair. But it does not matter much, because no despair of ours can alter the reality of things or stain the joy of the cosmic dance, which is always there. Indeed, we are in the midst of it, and it is in the midst of us, for it beats in our very blood, whether we want it to or not. Yet the fact remains that we are invited to forget ourselves on purpose, cast our awful solemnity to the winds, and join in the general dance. There are pencils, too, that Carl and Jim have if you need them.